on the upswing. I mean, I'm on the upswing. I'm not on the downswing. So, someone remind me what we spoke about last week?
Arab nationalism,
and who was the principal character in that?
The Mufti.
The Mufti of Jerusalem, Hajj al-Amin Husseini. And we talked about Jewish responses. Anybody remember the name of the Jewish group who was involved? Who was very peacenik oriented, very outreach oriented toward the Arabs?
Brit Shalom.
Brit Shalom, which attracted a whole set of luminaries. And someone, I don't remember who, made an excellent point when I asked, why would these people who were so bright go to this perspective that so few did? There were never more than 200 people in Brit Shalom, and then the political party they formed called Ichud. And someone had said, it's because these were people who were used to doing the impossible. You know, Henrietta Soule creating a whole organization, which...
I think you have to give yourself credit for that one.
Was that you?
Was it Aaron? All right.
My great comment.
That was a great comment. And Gershom Scholem, who invented the academic study of Kabbalah, and Judah Magnus, the first president of Hebrew University. I mean, really, the luminaries of the Jewish world at that time. And some of them were in Europe, too, like Martin Buber. I mean, we didn't talk about his philosophy of Ayin now, but he was a fantastically influential philosopher in his day. And controversial because of his peace stands as well. All right, tonight we're going to do hardcore Jewish nationalism. We're going to do revisionism, Zionist revisionism. Now, this has nothing to do with revisionist history, as sometimes you hear about the Holocaust or something like that. This is a school of thought, a new school of thought that emerges in the 1920s, because as we already know, there are camps in the Zionist movement. What are some of those camps or groupings? Anybody recall? What was Herzl? What was his label?
Political
Zionist. And what was Echad Ha'am?
Cultural.
And we talked about Rabbi Reines. He was a religious Zionist. And Ben-Gurion was a practical Zionist. And along comes a guy named Zev Vladimir Jabotinsky, who was going to become a revisionist Zionist. Some would say fascist. Some would give all a bunch of labels to him. The only reason we don't know more about Jabotinsky today is because he died of a heart attack at the age of 60 in 1940 at a Beitar youth group camp in upstate New York City. Had he lived another 15 or 20 years, he would have served in the Israeli Knesset, he would have been leader of the opposition, he would have been, he wouldn't have become prime minister, but he would have been known in the annals of the state of Israel as well. And, you know, we seem to find with some of these folks that they either die a little prematurely or they live forever. Seems to be the case with some of these guys. Chicken soup aside. All right. So it's a divide, by the way, that lasts until this day. What started as revisionism became the Likud Party. And today, when I interviewed once Yitzhak Shamir, the former prime minister of Israel, and over his shoulder was a huge etching of Vladimir Jabotinsky. You know, and that was in the 1990s. And Jabotinsky had died in 1940. So these guys remain vastly influential. There are major divides between what we'll call labor. But when we say labor, we're really talking about the left. The left wasn't splintered as it is today. I looked actually the other day at the seatings in the Israeli Knesset now, and there's all these different political parties. There were fewer political parties that made it to the Knesset then, because groups like Labor, which was Mapai then, at one point in the 51 elections, I think they got 56 or 57 seats, which was the most any party ever gotten. And, you know, various times Likud would get in the 30s and the 40s. Today, Likud is the leading party, and I think it has about 30 seats. I can't remember. Do you know the exact number? I can't remember. I looked at it. And that's combined with another group, Yisrael Beiteinu. Oh, by the way, I looked up something. We were disagreeing on Yisrael Beiteinu or Bayit Yehudi. Mm-hmm. They're two different parties.
Yeah.
They're both in the Knesset today.
Know.
I wasn't thinking of that. It escaped me, so I wanted to say, okay. You know, you got it. You got it. And if I have it right, Yisrael Beiteinu is the one that's in the government, and Bayit Yehudi is the one that's out. Well, no, actually, they're both in
the government.
One's joined with Likud,
yeah.
Yisrael Beiteinu. That's how Avigdor
Naftali
Lieberman
Bennett
is.
Naftali
Bennett is Bayit Yehudi.
Religious Zionist.
And the other one is Avigdor Lieberman.
Correct.
Who's now the foreign minister once again, who is definitely known as a right-wing politician. And for the right-wing secular Zionists, which is what these guys were, Jabotinsky was everything. And there were even rumors, or accusations, that Jabotinsky was a fascist. Now, fascist, by the way, wasn't as bad a word then as it is today. And you had fascists in Italy, right? Mussolini comes on the scene, what, 25 or 27, something like that. So you had a fascist government. You had fascist parties in other European countries. So fascism was just like you used to have, by the way, communist parties in all those countries, too. There was always concern that the communists were going to take over Italy. There was a time when there was concern the communists were going to take over France. It meant something different then, or it wasn't seen as radical then in some regards. All right, so the labor socialists, their ideology, to make it quick, is work with the British. Make the British live up to the Balfour Declaration, which is to create a Jewish national home. The labor Zionists didn't call for the creation of a Jewish state, and in fact rejected that concept until 1942. And the reason they rejected it is they were afraid that it would turn the British off, and they knew that they needed the British more than the British needed them. They were playing a little game of realpolitik as the weak person. 1942, at a conference called the Biltmore Conference at the Biltmore Hotel in New York City, which we'll talk about when we do World War II in 2 weeks. Next week's American Zionism in general. That's when they said that their goal was an independent Jewish state. And the reason was because of what was going on in Europe at that time. They felt, and because of the Arab pressures in terms of the violence was stepping up, and they knew they needed an independent state. They're, of course, socialists when it comes to the economy. They believe in a strong government, controlling all, most if not all, aspects of life, and they had the apparatus to do it. They controlled everything. They owned banks, they had school systems, they had labor unions, they had sick unions or healthcare operations, right? So it would be as if the Democrats had a healthcare operation, which some would argue they have today, or they're trying to have. But then the Republicans would have one, and the Independents would have one as well. Very powerful. The revisionists were capitalists. They aimed their base of support, which was middle-class Poland. And Poland's very important because sometimes we forget Poland had about 3.5 million Jews in the 1930s, the largest Jewish community in the world. And the Jews of the Soviet Union, probably about 1.5 to 2 million Jews, depending on the time, was cut off already by the 1930s. You couldn't access it anymore. Then, as now, by the way, there were roughly 14.5 million Jews in the world. It's just one way to see the impact of the Holocaust.
What year are you?
35, roughly, mid-30s. They increasingly didn't trust the British. At first, they said, we need the British, but we need to pressure the British to make them live up to their obligations. They said, we need an immediate state. And they said, don't trust the Arabs, because it's natural for the Arabs to fight us. Don't even try to reach out to them. So there were some sharp ideological divides between the revisionists and the socialists. Revisionism really took off in the 1930s when the world went crazy, right? It was a relatively understandable, I think, to move toward a strong man, like Jabotinsky, in a world of strong men. So that's the background with the rising fascist movements in Europe. And revisionism, we're going to talk about in a few minutes, indeed would have fascist characteristics. And it's, I've really enjoyed this course in many ways, but one thing that I've loved so much is to see, and fascinated by, the interaction between fascism and the rising Jewish state. Whether it was as simple as the Ad Lo Yada Purim parade, and they had huge swastikas on the floats marching down the streets of Tel Aviv, which is beyond comprehensible. Can you imagine if they did that today? I mean, people would go absolutely crazy. And we're going to see they did even more than that in this era. So as already stated, the man at the center of this is Zev Vladimir Jabotinsky. I have a couple pictures of him here. And he was a man who loved military life. He loved the trappings of military life. This is him during World War I. Anybody remember, we'll detail in a minute, what he did in World War I? The Zion Mule Corps. Ring a bell for anybody? Zion Mule Corps, the Battle of Gallipoli in 1916. With Trumpeldor, correct. He created that. And then they went and they created the Jewish Legion, which in 1918 went into Palestine with Allenby, who first went in 1917. And then they helped capture the second half, the northern part of the state, and then they went into Jordan or Transjordan, which what it technically was called. This is a more popular picture of him. This is really what he looks like. He's, you know, he's always described as an odd-looking fellow. It doesn't strike me as being particularly odd, but a number of the sources I looked at said that he had a strange-looking face. But
that's comparing him to all those guys.
With the beards, yeah, the great beards of Jewish history.
That was hiding their odd-looking face.
Well, he was very different in that he was secular and from secular origins, unlike almost everybody else who came from, or at least their parents came from, the shtetl. Right? He had no attachment to that whatsoever. So let me show a quick little film about him. Give you a little background. And with any luck, this will work. This is a very pro-John Matinsky film.
Zev Jabotinsky came to the Eclair Tirage Studios in Paris and delivered a speech in front of a movie camera. In the first three rows, he sat several family members and friends. They were the audience. The director yelled, "Action!" And turning to the viewers, Jabotinsky asked,
"Was hat die englische Regierung in jenem Moment gemeint mit dem Ausdruck Nationalheit?"
Occasionally, he rifled through the papers in front of him, using diagrams and graphs to illustrate his ideas. The film was meant to be distributed and screened simultaneously in various countries throughout the world. But it is not clear whether this indeed happened. Until then, only a few people had tried to use the medium of film to disseminate an organized doctrine, like that presented by Jabotinsky.
Think of how the fascists used film.
A broad spectrum of political and security issues, using a dense tapestry of demographic and social data, as well as economic issues. Everything came together in this speech. Everything led to one firm conclusion. The Jews must come to Eretz Yisrael urgently. These things were said only 1 year after the Nazis rose to power, and long before the skies of Europe darkened and storm clouds covered the continent. Jabotinsky's words were prophetic. They were said out of a deep understanding of historic and political processes, and a clear and knowledgeable awareness of demographic processes, including a correct reading of the world map and political trends. The film, whose quality after 70 years is surprising and deeply moving, has been preserved at the Jabotinsky Institute. On these shores and others, the first immigration ships began to arrive under the cover of darkness 85 years ago. The British referred to it as illegal immigration, while the Jews called it Aliyah Bet, or AFLP.
The revisionists were behind this, which they don't tell you.
In 1930 by the British government, Zev Jabotinsky, then one of the leaders of the Beitar movement and the leader of the revisionist Zionist faction in the World Zionist Organization, warned that it was necessary to come to Israel in every possible way and immediately. Zev Jabotinsky was born in Odessa in 1880, a leader, a writer, poet. He died in New York. He was 60 years old at the time of his death. For 24 years, the remains of the exiled leader remained on foreign soil, awaiting the order. It came on the 15th of March, 1964, a decision of the government of Israel, initiated by Prime Minister Levi Eshkol. Zev Jabotinsky's remains were brought to Israel 24 years after his death. He was buried in a state ceremony on Mount Herzl. The Jabotinsky Institute, which perpetuates the legacy of the Beitar leader, became an archive center that houses rare copies and various publications of the movement. Its beginnings were modest. Eventually, the institute moved to Mitzudat Ze'ev, the Likud headquarters in Tel Aviv. In 1958, the Jabotinsky archives were recognized as public archives according to the archives law.
המיוחד בארכיון שלנו, שהוא הארכיון בעצם היחיד בעולם, שהחומרים שלו הם החומרים של זאב ז'בוטינסקי ותנועתו, ואת כל התנועות האחרות שקמו ברוחו. יש לנו גם את כל הארכיונים של מוסדות התנועה הרוויזיוניסטית, בגולה וגם בארץ ישראל. יש לנו ארכיון של מחתרת אצ"ל, ארגון הצבאי הלאומי, וגם חומרים שקשורים בלח"י, חומרים של נילי, ברית הבריונים, ועוד ועוד ועוד.
47 years later, the Jabotinsky Law, similar in its general outline to the Herzl Law, was passed, reflecting the recognition by the State of Israel and the encouragement it gives to the perpetuation and study of Zev Jabotinsky's doctrines and the history of the revisionist movement. The law also determines that exhibits and documents connected to the work of Zev Jabotinsky and the revisionist movement should be preserved and restored.
אני מסביר לרבים מהאורחים המגיעים לישראל, ראשי פרלמנטים, ראשי מדינות, נשיאים, שהצורך של העם היהודי במדינה בא לידי ביטוי אולי כדוגמה בשואה הנוראה שנפלה עלינו. אני מסביר להם שז'בוטינסקי בא ואמר זאת עוד ב-1923, כאשר כתב את מאמרו קיר הברזל. אנחנו נחזור לארצנו, משום שאין לנו ארץ אחרת, משום שאנחנו לא יכולים להתקיים כבודדים מבלי שנתקיים כעם.
Next to the institute, a museum was also opened where study days and seminars for the public are held.
אנחנו זקוקים לפחות להכפלת השטח כאן בבניין, גם כדי להרחיב את נפח הפעילות, אבל גם כדי שנוכל לשמר טוב יותר את החומרים ההיסטוריים הדוקומנטריים שנמצאים ברשותנו, ואנחנו מקווים שבעתיד הקרוב נוכל להגשים את החלום הזה.
The Jabotinsky Institute initiates research and publishes books in various publications. A reading room with computer stations and a microfilm reader machine is open to the public. The various documents that arrived in Israel after World War II from abroad include posters, articles, and thousands of letters that Jabotinsky wrote during his travels throughout the world. They were collected by the Institute's founder, Joseph Ba'amuni, and are meticulously preserved in display cases. In every city in Israel, there are streets, schools, and institutions named after Zev Jabotinsky. Explanatory signs have recently been placed on the facade of the house in which Zev Jabotinsky lived in Jerusalem, and for which he was arrested, which also describe portions of his life. The British forbade Jabotinsky's entry into Eretz Yisrael, since he was urging European Jewry to violate the White Paper and come to Israel. As part of the joint project conducted by the Government of Israel, spearheaded by the Office of the Prime Minister, together with Karen Ha-Yisod, it was decided to help implement the Jabotinsky Law. The preservation and restoration of Jabotinsky's heritage are an indivisible part of the Jewish people in Israel and abroad. This is a call to Karen Ha-Yisod supporters.
כל מי שעוזר לקרן היסוד בעניין זה עוזר לקביעת מורשת ישראל ולמורשת התנועה הציונית ומדינת ישראל כדבר שהוא בבחינת והגדת לבנך, בבחינת לימוד הדורות הבאים, מה שהיה, שכן בלי מה שהיה, איך נדע איך יהיה.
We have returned to the shores of Tel Aviv, the first Hebrew city, to whose waters the first immigrant boats arrived. It is here that they first stepped on the land of Eretz Israel. From here, they were never uprooted.
All right. So, you get the picture that he was a swell guy, which of course you know isn't really the whole story. And we're going to go into that right now. Jabotinsky, in fact, was probably the most controversial guy that checked that he was the most controversial guy of Zionist movement. Let's see. Do we want that one out, or which one does it matter?
This one win that one out?
Yeah, I don't know. They're both, I have them both on right now. Let's see. Let me turn that one on, see. Yeah, okay, I got it. Oh, that's weird. Zev Vladimir Jabotinsky, let me give you, let's see, some labels that he was called during his career. Charismatic leader, brilliant essayist, radical demagogue, extraordinary orator, gifted poet, moving author, dangerous militarist, Jewish patriot, arch-fascist, advocate for the bourgeois, blessed polyglot, and gifted communicator. So it really depended on what side you came down on. He was the man, and he took all the darts that were set toward the revisionists. And as we're going to see, some of his followers deviated from his line, from his discipline, and went on and founded really radical groups, really radical splinter groups that he couldn't control, even though he tried. So as stated, he lived 1880 to 1940. He was born in Odessa. Now, this is not the Odessa that we've studied so far. Jabotinsky was from a middle-class family. His father was a wheat trader, and his mother owned a stationery store. He was educated at state schools. He had nothing to do with the organized Jewish community, other than, just like Herzl, most of the people he associated with were Jewish, but very, very assimilated. He learned Hebrew a little bit as a kid, but that was probably just for his bar mitzvah. I only found a passing reference to that, which he would learn fluently and masterfully in later years. He was a gifted polyglot. He really picked up languages quite quickly. The closest he could reach back to the ghetto or the shtetls were his grandfathers, right? And once, there was only one side, I think, that one of his grandfathers came from the shtetl. The others, their fathers came from the shtetl. So they had been assimilated unusually quickly, even in Russia, or in Russia at that time. His first passion, the first thing that captivated him, was journalism, which is why I liked him so much. At age 16, he wrote for a local Russian newspaper called the Odessa Leaflet. And he wrote and wrote and wrote. They mentioned his letters. He wrote letters voluminously. He wrote articles voluminously. And many of them have been saved. Many of them have been published in book form. And the institute there has many of them. Well, I have not been to that institute yet, but I'd like to go just to kind of poke around a little bit. Odessa Leaflet sent him, when he hit 18, as a correspondent to both Italy and Switzerland, where he picked up German and where he picked up Italian very quickly. He wrote under the pseudonym Altalina, which means swing in Italian. I don't know why he picked that name, but he did. Anyone ever heard of the Altalina?
Wasn't that the ship that they, I think they tried to bring in some
around.
People?
I thought they sunk that.
They sunk it.
Right, in June of 1948.
The Jews sunk a Jewish ship. It was like
right,
the
socialist labor forces sunk a ship. Right, in 1948, which was the Irgun ship bringing weapons in for the Irgun, breaking a UN-imposed ceasefire. But that's beyond our dates.
Right.
So,
that
but,
was Jew on Jew.
We're going to get to some more Jew on Jew in a little bit. He went to law school in Rome in his spare time. He stayed a working journalist all throughout. He was well known for his dispatches, which were known as Fullertons. I don't know if you remember that name, but that's the style of writing that Theodor Herzl wrote. It was kind of reflective essays when Herzl was in Paris for the... I can't remember the name of the German newspaper.
Getting old.
Oh, well. All right. So he married a woman named Johanna or Jean in 1907. They had one son named Ari, and Ari briefly served as a Knesset member in the first Knesset. He just didn't win re-election, his seat on the Herut slate. Like many, Jabotinsky's awakening was the Kishinev pogroms in 1903. And we've spoken about that before, how devastating they were to people who thought that they were coming into a century of progress. Find literally people decapitated in the streets. Not a huge number of body, a huge body count by our standards today. I believe it was 58, or maybe 85. I might be inversing the numbers. But at that time, it was very shocking, obviously. So he became active in the Zionist movement. And there were rumors of more pogroms to come. And with that, he decided to get active in Jewish self-defense movements. There were efforts of Jewish self-defense all throughout the Russian Empire. That, you know, we know they're coming, let's get some weapons, we'll put up some barricades, we're not going to let them run roughshod over us. So they would actually put up a fight. It's a chapter in Jewish history that's not a large one, but is often forgotten, and it's ripe for a great movie. Just like they made Defiance, if anyone's ever seen that, from the Bielski brothers. His slogan was, better to have a gun and not need it than to need it and not have it. That's logical.
It's today.
Right. Well, or what's it, the JDL, the Jewish Defense League, one of their mottos used to be, every Jew at 32. So, okay, that floats your boat, you know. He set himself the goal of learning Hebrew and Yiddish. Within 2 years, he was fluent in Hebrew and Yiddish, which is pretty impressive. Take it from one who struggled all his life to try and be fluent in Hebrew. It's not so easy. He took on the name Ze'ev, which means wolf. He was quickly the Zionists in Odessa were thrilled to have the famed author, journalist, Altalina in their camp, so they persuaded him to go to the Zionist Congress as one of their delegates in 1903. He voted against the Uganda proposal. Anybody, real quickly, what was the Uganda proposal?
They settled Jews in Uganda.
Nordahl said, a Nachtstahl, a night refuge. That it wasn't going to be permanent, but nonetheless, and Chadam and everybody else went crazy, and Herzl had to declare, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its cunning, and let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. He began editing the Russian Zionist publication, Jewish Life. 3 years later, it became the official publication of the Russian Zionist movement. So he had a platform, and that's what he wanted more than anything else. Guy loved the spotlight. On its pages, in particular, he railed against the Socialist Bund. The Bund was that anti-Zionist socialist group with which the Zionist groups competed for the heart and soul of the Jewish people at that time. His rhetorical skills made him a highly requested speaker for the Zionist causes. You know, just like today, you know, BZD brings in a good speaker each year. Well, you would bring in a good Zionist speaker each year or every 3 months or whatever you would. However you would do it. All right, we talked about during World War I, he conceived of the Jewish Legion. So in 1915, he and Joseph Trumpeldor, the one-armed, soon-to-be one-armed Joseph Trumpeldor, who lose his arm in battle. No, he lost his arm in the Russian Sino-Japanese War. Sino-Russian War in 1903-1905. With the one-armed Trumpeldor, he would form the Zion Mule Corps. They would have a good record in the Battle of Gallipoli, which was a long, they called it the battle, but it was about a year-long battle. It was really drawn out. In 1919, he complained to General Allenby, commander of the British forces in Palestine and Egypt and Jordan, about anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism within the British Army, while Jabotinsky was dismissed from active duty about then, not coincidentally. So he was also named, however, by the Zionist organization as the political officer of something called the Zionist Commission. The Zionist Commission was a short-lived group, 1918 and 1922, that act as the representative of the Jewish community in Palestine before the mandate was officially given to Britain. It wasn't officially given until 1923, but military rule was relinquished in 1922 by the Brits, which we covered. So he was in charge of relations with the British military, ironically. He became active in self-defense and training Jews to use weapons. This was around 1919. The Haganah would come into being into 1920. He would have some involvement with that. We had, did anybody remember the group that preceded the Haganah? HaShomer. HaShomer was there first. They were smaller and not as well organized, but he got involved with them as well. 1920, we remember there were riots in Jerusalem called the Nebi Musa riots, the Prophet Moses riots. This is where the soon-to-be Mufti of Jerusalem was arrested and jailed. Well, Jabotinsky was arrested and jailed as well. The reason is he was the head of the Haganah in Jerusalem. As the head of Haganah in Jerusalem, you won't be surprised to learn that when the British searched his apartment, they found 3 rifles, 2 pistols, 250 rounds of ammunition. He was arrested and tried and sentenced to 15 years in jail. Now, in 1922, when the first High Commissioner, Samuels, came, we remember when Samuels came, he gave amnesty to Jabotinsky as well as to the Mufti and everybody who was involved in that. Jabotinsky fought that. He said, I don't want to be freed because you're letting these people go, and they started it, even though a British Commission of Inquiry basically said the Jews were responsible for it. But they said, too bad, you're freed anyway. The court, by the way, had claimed that Jabotinsky's and others were Bolsheviks. Now, they were socialists, and Jabotinsky started as a socialist, but they weren't Bolsheviks. They might have been Mensheviks, and at that time, it was a very important distinction. There were basically no Jews who were Bolsheviks, or very few.
What was the distinction?
The Bolsheviks were cutthroat, and they would kill you if you disagreed with you. It was Lenin versus Trotsky, basically. And also, the Leninists or the Communists were for an even stronger control of the economy than were the Mensheviks. They were still Communists, but they were more for the socialist side than the Communist side, which is for a stronger control of the economy. So it's. I actually sat through and tried to read through their differences once, and it gave me a headache. But I encourage you to do it. I guess you won't now. All right. In 1921, he was elected to the Zionist Organization's Executive Council. So here's a guy, he's 41 years old now, and he's at the top of the Zionist world. He's been working in the Zionist world for a while now. He's part and parcel of the establishment, and that's important to the story. He is a founder and the first director of propaganda for the Keren Hayesod. Keren Hayesod is the United Israel Appeal, which is UJA outside of the United States. So it was obviously much bigger then, when the Jewish community was much bigger outside of the United States. But he kept spatting with mainstream Zionist leaders. He kept demanding that they demand more from the British. He was upset because the mainstream Zionist leaders wouldn't call for a Jewish state on both banks of the Jordan River. Right, in 1922, in the Churchill White Paper, we see the Transjordan is cut off from the Palestine Mandate. Now, there's a Palestine Mandate and there's a Transjordan Mandate, or even country. And he said, the goal is a state, and let's not fool anybody. So ultimately, he resigned in 23 from the Zionist Executive. They weren't upset to see him go. They weren't upset at all. But he wasn't done by any stretch of the imagination. He started a party called the Alliance of Revisionist Zionists. This was a party within the Zionist organization, and they successfully ran candidates in the Zionist elections that sent people to the Zionist congresses. And each year they would get more and more. There were anywhere from 300 to 400 delegates to the Zionist Congress, roughly.
What does revisionist mean in these terms?
Looking at history and the Zionist cause in a new way, revising it. That's literally what it means, revising our understanding of it. Again, it's a bad phrase today because there are Holocaust revisionist historians out there. But obviously we didn't have that then. So he said you have to look at, and that was the formal name, was revisionist. And I don't know of any other time in modern history that that was used in a political party's name. You know, just in this Jewish case, which is kind of interesting in its own right. All right. Jabotinsky summarized the revisionist ideology like this. Someone want to read this one for me? Any volunteers?
Mitch? The program is not complicated. The aim of Zionism is a Jewish state, the territory, both sides of the Jordan, the system, mass colonization, the solution to the financial problem, a national loan. These 4 principles cannot be realized without international sanction. Hence, the commandment of the hour, a new political campaign, and the militarization of Jewish youth in Eretz Israel and the diaspora.
And that's interesting because that's kind of a, oh, by the way, we're going to militarize everybody, which really goes against Jewish history since 135 CE. And he is coming out and saying things such as, there's been no time in history when a nation has recaptured its land without military conquest, without celebrating military battles. And he believes in military order and discipline, and studies military historians. And he believes this is the key to refounding the glory of the Jewish people. And it's pretty straightforward. And you see, he's still talking about cooperating with the British at this point. And I'll move this one up a little. We'll get to it in a minute. And this is from something that we read. So as I said, Jabotinsky knew that he needed the help of the British to make it happen. If anything, he wasn't a fool. He, in fact, saw himself as the heir to Herzl and Nordau, that he was a political Zionist. He wasn't one of these practical socialist Zionists. He was a political Zionist, and he was going to go around and talk to the leaders of the world and get them to agree to what he believes is the right thing to do. Increasingly, he hated socialism, which he had started as. He was saying things like, not only the militarization of the Jewish youth, but we must have a Jewish army now. Now, Jabotinsky is uniquely qualified to say we must have a Jewish army now because he started the Jewish brigade in the British Army. Nobody else can say that. And the Haganah is nothing to speak of, really, until 1930, after the 29 riots. Meanwhile, he came up with economic and social policies. He put out papers. He appealed to the middle class. He said, we're your friends. The socialists aren't your friends. And this was increasingly popular in the Baltic countries and in Poland as well, which we had mentioned. His attitude toward the Brits began shifting by 1931. There had been a series of riots. The British had gone back and forth on immigration. He became impatient. His followers wanted action. Things were worsening for Jews in Europe. So eventually, you're going to start seeing attacks against the British themselves. Still going to wait a few more years, but there's a lot of rumblings on that. Now, I want to talk about for a moment about his policy toward the Arabs. Remember when we first started out in the course, in the early years of Zionism, few people were really addressing the Arabs, and that's why it was a big shock when Ahad Ha'am did in 1889 with his essay, This Is Not the Way, Lo Ze HaDerech. He said, Jabotinsky gave much attention to this, that Arab opposition was inevitable. Don't think that it's not going to happen and act accordingly. He said, the difference is we Jews have a stronger case. And this is exactly what some say today. They have many countries they can go to. We are suffering. Our people. He is the first one who was really saying there's going to be a crisis in Europe of great magnitude. There's only one place that our folks can come, and it's here in the land of Israel. He literally came out and said, our need is greater than theirs. Now, the socialists weren't going to say that because it would have upset the British, and they had, again, that realpolitik relationship going on there. And they were, if anything, trying to mollify Arab nationalism, whereas this would inflame Arab nationalism. I'll just toss it out for discussion, and I don't know the answer to this. At that point, say mid-late 1920s, you have immigration coming in, you have Arab violence starting to pick up a little. What's the best policy toward the Arabs?
Get rid of the trouble.
No?
From some of the readings that I did, my impression was that he had no respect for the Arabs. He didn't like their culture. He thought they were 500 years behind.
He said different things at different times, too.
But he also, from day one, realized that they had a claim to this land, and I think this was at the core of his rivalry with Ben-Gurion, that Ben-Gurion had this feeling that if we show them a thriving economy, if we raise their standard of living, of course they would see the benefits of all of this, and he said no.
Right, right. Yeah, we're going to get to that in a second, actually. No, you're right on target.
But I think that, just generally speaking, his view... There are some nuances. I don't know if I've read propaganda.
He's a great propagandist. That wasn't a dirty word in that era.
But,
remember, he was director of propaganda for the, what was the UIA? Karen Hayes.
Now it's called PR.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, continue. Do you have more you want to say?
Well, I do, but I mean, if you're getting to it, I'll let you get to it.
Oh, sorry. Anyone else have any thoughts on, you know, you have, this is new, right? This is two, it's not new, actually. You've had two distinct camps before in Zionist history. You had the cultural Zionists, and you had the political Zionists. And you had the big battle in 1903 over Uganda. Now you have two distinct camps again. You have the labor socialists, and you have the revisionists. And they have two distinct ways of looking at things.
But they have, just the thing that I want to add to that is that Jabotinsky, even though he really was a racist about the Arab culture from what I've read, he did never for one minute underestimated the fact that these were people with a nationalist pride and that the minute they sniffed that their environment was changing, they were going to dig in for battle, and you had to be prepared for that.
Right.
And that nothing would ever change. Now, at the same time, he was saying he wants to make peace with the Arabs, but it will never change until they accept our right to be here, and you can see the seeds of it today.
Well, we're going to read a little from On the Iron Wall. Did you get a chance to read that? Yeah, so a lot of it's in that.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts?
He proved to be right, by the way.
He proved to... Yes, but...
If you look at the Arab point of view, clearly they say even today, we're never going to compromise. We're never going to recognize the state of Israel as a Jewish nation. And that's... That has been the line.
Okay.
And they've not deviated from it at all. It's only the Israelis who keep compromising. The Arabs never compromise.
That's why I think that Netanyahu takes the position he does today as like a descendant of this world.
Netanyahu's father was for a while secretary to Jabotinsky.
But the Jabotinsky, I felt, was very clear in that you cannot give an inch until they relent and say, you have a right to be here.
Right.
It's the story of today.
And they have repeatedly said, and we're not going to do that, period.
And that's what this iron wall was about. It was this iron will of a wall.
Right. Any other thoughts? Anybody? As you say, it's a debate that goes on till today. And it has a lot of nuances and a lot of sharp, distinct features to it. So we're going to read an excerpt from On the Iron Wall, which was one of the readings, and this was written in 1923, so it was pretty early on in his Zionist career, and it first appeared in a Russian emigre magazine called Rasvet, which was published in Berlin and had influence in those circles. And by the way, I looked on the internet for this. I found three different translations in English, so I'm not going to tell you this is the definitive one. This is from the Jewish Virtual Library that a guy named Mitchell Bard runs.
Did they disagree?
No. It was just some nuances. But it was enough to make me suspicious as a reader of history. You know, I want to know what's exact. I didn't find an original Hebrew one, or I assume it was in Russian. Anyway, can I get anybody to read this? It's a little long. Yeah.
I consider it utterly impossible to eject the Arabs from Palestine. There will always be two nations in Palestine.
So I'm going to interrupt as we go along. Okay. This guy's not a dreamer, right? He might be an ideologue, but he's not a dreamer.
Okay. Which is good enough for me, provided the Jews become the majority. I am prepared to take an oath binding ourselves and our descendants that we shall never do anything contrary to the principle of equal rights, and that we shall never try to eject anyone, which was in opposition to Ben-Gurion, who wanted to transfer.
Well, Ben-Gurion considered transfer at one point, but by 1920 he had ruled it out, to be fair. What? Now, other things happened during the War of Independence.
Right.
Sorry. That's all right. Other things happened during the War of Independence, but as Clausewitz famously said, that was the fog of war.
There can be no voluntary agreement between ourselves and the Palestine Arabs, not now, nor in the prospective future. To imagine, as our Arabophiles do, that they will voluntarily consent to the realization of Zionism in return for the moral and material conveniences which the Jewish columnist brings with him is a childish notion, which has at bottom a kind of contempt for the Arab people. It means that they despise the Arab race, which they regard as a corrupt mob that can be bought and sold, and are willing to give up their fatherland for a good railway system. Every native population in the world resists colonists as long as it has the slightest hope of being able to rid itself of the danger of being colonized. The Zionists want only one thing, Jewish immigration.
By the way, he's wrong. They want a Jewish state. He's just not saying that. They want immigration and a state.
And this Jewish immigration is what the Arabs do not want. Colonization can have only one aim, and Palestine Arabs cannot accept this aim. This does not mean that we can continue reading.
There we go.
This does not mean that there cannot be any agreement with the Palestine Arabs. What is impossible is a voluntary agreement. As long as the Arabs feel that there is the least hope of getting rid of us, they will refuse to give up this hope in return for either kind words or for bread and butter, because they are not a rabble, but a living people. And when a living people yields in matters of such a vital character, it is only when there is no longer any hope of getting rid of us, because they can make no breach in the iron wall. Not till then will they drop their extremist leaders, whose watchword is never.
So that's pretty much along the lines of how you summarized it. Any reactions to this?
Well, just that we have the iron wall, and they still haven't dropped their extremist leaders.
With the wall.
Right. Okay. We have the wall 60 years,
they still see
later.
A possibility of getting rid of us, though.
Yeah, well, that could go on forever.
Yeah, I'm not sure how iron the wall has been.
It's a fence. Yeah. I mean, it's a security fence. It's not really an iron wall.
It's not a physical thing. It's the self-defense of Jews, you know,
can you define iron wall?
Yeah, the way he's meaning it is that we have a unquestionable majority in military strength, so nobody can overcome us.
And that's
he doesn't mean a physical
today.
Wall.
Yeah, but Israel keeps in all the...
Let's not do too much on modern Israel.
It's
not that that's not in my heart. I totally get it.
Because the seeds are so pure in Israel.
But it's nothing new, right? In chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun.
Right, so Aaron? They know we're not going to use it.
I thought it was interesting. I don't know where it was in here, but somewhere near that, where he had mentioned about the Native Americans and how, you know,
right. I remember that reference.
They had, you know, a piece of this vast land that they still felt like, you know, this example that they had to fight when they probably, you know, could have had something and not had to fight and then have
right.
been decimated. So it was just amazing.
Don't you think they knew that it wouldn't end? It just. You know, that we would end up coming across.
Right. Well, and we've talked about it before, last week even, I think. These are two competing nationalist identities that can't make room for one another.
That's with every country.
Yeah. Look at Cyprus, they had to divide the whole country.
Right. I mean,
there are historical, there are plenty of countries where that's not true. United States for one of them.
Is what?
Mm-hmm. Well, we had to slaughter the natural people.
Right.
I have a friend who's an American Indian. He said there were 163 treaties with the Indian nations and the U.S. government. The U.S. government broke every one of them.
All right. Look, and by the same token, in 47 and 48, there was a massive transfer of population in Pakistan and India. Right? So there are other examples in history that, for better or worse, worked. That's not an ideal situation now. There are war in the Himalayas. What's the province? Kashmir.
So it didn't work.
Well, but it's not seen as that serious a conflict. It's really a Cold War at this point. It flares up periodically, but it's not existential for either country.
Pakistan hasn't used their nukes yet.
I don't even think I know how.
Yeah.
But one question I have is, does it become like a self-fulfilling prophecy, though? It's like when you take this attitude and create that environment,
it's a great question. It's a great question.
Situation.
How does it become self-fulfilling as opposed to being a realist?
Yeah.
Well, he's certainly saying he's a realist, and he's using history to suggest that he's a realist, but the question is, was it possible to have a more friendly way to do it?
Well, there's another thing going on, too.
He's
not in power, right? It's a lot easier to criticize those in power and be an ideologue out of power than it is in power. You know, Ariel Sharon became prime minister in 2001, in Rosh Hashanah 2002, I don't know if I ever mentioned this to you guys, Every year, before just a few days before Rosh Hashanah, the Prime Minister invites the editors of the leading newspapers of the country into his office, and they have a chat. And he said, "Things look different from in here." And we know Ariel Sharon wound up giving back the Gaza Strip, which, you know, nobody would have thought would have happened.
But who would have thought Nixon would go to China?
Right, right. And that Begin would give back, you know, the Sinai, and, you know, so on and so on. So, who's to say? Strange things happen. When you're in power, it's different. And who would have thought, you know, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, I never would have thought Netanyahu would be negotiating with the Palestinians. You know, the fact he's even negotiating with them surprises me in some regards, based on stuff he said earlier in his career. Anyway, I think what you're saying is, and one of the reasons why you study history, is this stuff stays with us. These folks really hit on something, something that matters until today. And you can find the echoes of their philosophy, even more so than the echoes, in the leaders of today. Because they were all raised by the mothers and fathers of the people who followed these people. And so on, and so on, and so on. As we said, Benzion Netanyahu was the secretary to Jabotinsky in the 1930s. One of the secretaries.
Jabotinsky had his way with things a lot
different. Yes, but who's to say? I mean,
I
you
know,
make.
I'm asking
yeah.
a question.
Oh.
They would or they would.
You know, I generally, as a historian, try not to get into that type of scenario because so many things would happen. I was having a conversation with someone today about if the Holocaust didn't happen, this person said there wouldn't be a state of Israel, to which I strongly disagreed because it wiped out the most Zionist part of Europe, and the British clamped down on immigration in 39 because of World War II, so that the Arabs would be on their side and not for the Nazis. So it's hard to say. If Jabotinsky had had his way, there's a secret here that Jabotinsky's not talking about. Did so many Jews in Poland and the Baltic states and elsewhere want to move to Palestine? That's a big question, too. You know, what would have made it so they wanted to move there?
Well, he tried his level best going and railing against them that the 11th hour was the clock.
He said the great catastrophe is coming, yeah.
Yeah.
The great catastrophe is coming. And he had plans to bring a million Jews there.
That's
we're going to talk a little bit about that.
Both sides of the Jordan.
Right, right.
For
but
mass.
The other side of the Jordan, by the way, the East Bank, has no infrastructure
yeah.
whatsoever.
Not much going on there.
You know, particularly in the 1920s and 1930s. I mean, even today, it's basically desert. You know, I mean, Amman and all is in the northwest of the country, but there's a whole expanse of the country. It's nothing. I don't know how many people are in Jordan right now, but I'd be surprised if it was 2 or 3 million, you know, because Israel has about 7.5 million or so. All right, where were we? All right, by the way, he had no qualms when it came to his feelings on religion. Religious nationalism was not a big deal at this point, which enabled him to say, right, in Haaretz, I think that's supposed to be 1919, internationally we will announce that those Jews who do not remove the rust of exile from themselves and refuse to shave their beard and sidelocks will be second-class citizens. They will not be given the right to vote. So he didn't really like the people from the old Yeshuv, and he really didn't have any need for the modern Orthodox Zionists, who were relatively small at this point. He would later, in the 1930s, put a pro-religious plank in the revisionist platform at one of the conventions, because he wanted to woo the rabbis of Eastern Europe in Poland and the Baltic states, because that would be yet another way to get people against the socialists, because they certainly weren't going to favor the socialists, and to be kind to him because he felt they needed to be encouraged to move to Israel because of the storm clouds that were brewing. And we know the storm clouds were certainly brewing. Now we're doing a couple more minutes. All right. All along, he continues to find outlets for his articles. In 1923, he revives the Jewish weekly Rosvet, which means dawn, which is publishing in Berlin and Paris. We talked about that a moment ago. That's where he published On the Iron Wall. He wrote novels. He was a historical novelist. Remember I talked about in one of the very early classes, some of the proto-Zionists would publish romantic novels that took place in biblical times in Hebrew, in the land of Israel. Well, he wrote historical novels. One was called Samson the Nazarite, 1927, and that's in the Stanislavski book, which, boy, if I looked up every word I didn't know, Stanislavski used. That was, even trying to figure it out from context, I don't know. Anyone else have that problem?
Yes.
Yeah. He's an academic and a half, I guess. In 1935, he wrote a book called The Five, which actually was a little later. It's a description of Odessa in modern times and his views on that. So you have a guy writing novels, he's writing speeches, he's writing letters, he's writing newspaper articles. He's a busy guy. We'll do one more thing, then we'll take a break. As the storm clouds continued to mount, he felt that revisionist Zionism needed to be turned into a rescue operation. Not rescue and relief, like American Jewish operations call themselves today, but a rescue operation. So what he said was, we're going to take 1.5 Eastern and Central European Jews to the land of Israel. We're going to do this in a 10-year period. Now, keep in mind, that's still a minority. It's going to make a significant impact in the land of Israel, but it's still a minority. So just like Herzl, he began rounds of diplomacy, going around to heads of state, trying to persuade them. He said, look, I'm an important Zionist leader. I literally have hundreds of thousands, if not a million or two, people following me, and he did. And I want you to consider this. So he met with the Polish foreign minister, Hungary's regent, and the prime minister of Romania. All three governments approved of the plan. Now, the Polish Jews went crazy at him. Why do you think the Polish Jews went crazy at him? They didn't want to leave, and they said he was kowtowing to anti-Semites who just wanted to kick them out. And he was encouraging them. And they felt that it would spike anti-Semitism. Right? There's a question in this modern era. Are you dealing with anti-Semitism and keeping it low, or are you ignoring it? And that's the existential question of European Jewry in the 1920s through a good chunk in the 1930s as well. It didn't matter because the Brits vetoed the idea anyway. And Weizmann for the Zionist organization said, it ain't happening. So here in 38, Jabotinsky warns Polish Jews were, quote, living on the edge of a volcano and super pogroms were coming. 1938, who's to say? That was before Kristallnacht, by the way, which was in November. All right, let's take a break of that. We'll go from there.